any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, 'I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them.' But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." This is the word of the Lord.
I'm going to be a jolly sight more careful what I say to Karen in emails in the future. But it is true, that's a really pretty obscure passage. And some of it is extremely difficult to understand. So what do we make of it? Several people have said to me, do we really believe what Genesis is all about? Isn't it myth and legend? Is it got any relevance for us today? I see some. What do you think she's up to? I don't suppose anybody's worked that out, and I hope they haven't actually. Let me tell you the parable of the flashing light. There was a scientist, a very eminent physicist, walking along the beach, and he saw out at sea a light flashing. Now, as a good scientist, he had all the right equipment in his car, which is very close. So he went to his car and he pulled out a stopwatch and he timed the flashes so he knew exactly how long each flash took. And then he had a thing called a photometer. Some of you will know more about that than I do. But he measured the brightness of the flashes. Then he had a spectrometer and he recorded their spectrum. And then as he walked along the beach, he made triangular calculations from various places in order to check the exact distance between himself and the flashing lights. And he thought that was great and very exciting. And he went home and he said to his wife, "I've seen the most extraordinary thing." And I'm going to read this because I'm not a physicist. I want to get it right. He said, "I saw what I deduced was a heated tungsten filament enclosed in a silica envelope, emitting a regular pattern of flashes of visible radiation at an intensity of 2,500 lumens from a distance of about 850 meters from the shore." Accurate, precise, true. But that same evening, a teenager was walking home along the shore, and he saw the same flashing light. And he was very late home. He'd been at Sea Scouts, and he was late home, and his mother was very worried. What on earth has happened to him? Where's he been? And when he came in the door, she said, "Where have you been? And why do you look so excited and so pleased with yourself?" "Ah," said the boy, "I saw a boat signaling SOS out at sea in Morse code, and I telephoned the Coast Guard, and they sent out a lifeboat, and they rescued the guys in the boat." Now, which was more accurate in their presentation of the facts? The physicist or the Sea Scout? Who was more accurate? And the answer is neither of them, because they were both absolutely precise and accurate. What they said in both cases was totally true. But they approached the truth from completely different directions. The scientist asked how. The Sea Scout asked why. We live in a culture in our 21st century where for most people, scientific knowledge is the truth. Scientific explanations are precise, they're accurate, and they can be agreed by all. Other people, politicians, as we've seen in the last few weeks, economists, theologians, cannot give that kind of accuracy of the scientific facts which are agreed by all. There's always going to be open to debate. And as a result of that, our culture makes two assumptions which are wrong. One, in the area of human experience that is not open to scientific study, that's basically morality and religion, truth is either purely relative or it's absolutely non-existent. You think that's true? Fine, that's okay by me. You can believe what you like. I don't care. It's irrelevant to me. And that's where most people are at. Or, second assumption, anything that needs to question or challenge scientific ideas must be treated with suspicion. It must be regarded as wrong. The Bible is ignored or rejected as out of date. The point I'm making is if you and I are going to make any sense at all of these chapters of Genesis, we have to see that there are two kinds of truth. Scientific truth, which asks how, what I'm calling moral truth, which asks why. They don't contradict each other. What the physicists said was absolutely accurate. But it only answered one question. It didn't answer the question why. What the Sea Scout said was absolutely accurate, but he was answering a different question. For example, what's the value of a human being? How valuable is a human being? We had a big debate in my newspaper, at least recently, where that young child crawled into the cage of a gorilla and was in danger of his life. Which was more valuable, the gorilla or the little child? Well, in some terms, the gorilla was far more valuable. It cost a lot more money to replace the gorilla than it did the child. But in fact, the zoo took the moral decision to shoot the gorilla to save the life of the child. Many of us were challenged when that coast guard in Greece was pictured with a baby aged for 18 months or something in his arms, a dead child, somebody trying to flee from Turkey into Greece. What's the value of a human being? And the story of Noah and the other stories we're looking at in these early chapters of Genesis, they're not inaccurate, they're not lacking in scientific accuracy, but they're not primarily designed to give us those answers. They're answering a different question. They're answering the question, why? Now, we will look in great detail in part two, if you can bide your souls in patience as you want to, as to what these verses mean, because they are incredibly obscure. Why should men be described as the sons of God and women be described as the daughters of men? Is it sexist rubbish? Many people accuse it. And who on earth were the Nephilim? If anybody knows during the coffee break, please come and tell me, because the theologians have been arguing about it for 2,000 years. But I think we may have an answer. The important crux of the passage is verse 5. The Lord God saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was evil. And so God did something about it, because God, as supreme but as righteous at the end of the day cannot tolerate unrighteousness and wrong attitude. But the other half of the equation, it's so important, is verse 8. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. God judges. That's what we're learning from this chapter of Genesis. God condemns wrongdoing and he judges. But when God produces judgment, he also always provides a means of escape, salvation. In our culture today, the lights are flashing. And you and I have three choices, three options. We can ignore them, or we can analyze them scientifically and explain the science about what's happening, or we can send for the lifeboat. And God provides a lifeboat. The choice is yours and mine.